You're listening to the Weekly Portland Podcast, a slice of city life every Monday. I'm your host, Gregory Day. On today's show, I talk with Sarah Iannarone. She made waves in the mayor's race, and now she's continuing her work with First Stop Portland at PSU. Her day job involves meeting delegates from all over the world, so we wanted to learn more about that, as well as her future political aspirations. This is BDXPodcast.com featuring today's special guest, Sarah Iannarone. Say you won. Say you were the mayor right now.
Well, no one would be. I would be the mayor-elect, but yeah. So, say I were the mayor-elect.
Now, what
Can
would
I
be...
have tens of wealth while we're at it? Let's say I'm rich and I'm mayor-elect. That would be good.
Doesn't sound bad. First 100 days, what would be on your agenda?
When you think about what are my priorities...
And you placed well. You did very well
in
this election.
Better than most folks expected, and I think... There was pent-up demand for what I was saying in large part. It's why I entered the race when I first observed, Ted Wheeler and Jules Bailey debating urban issues. I saw, one, a huge disconnect from the reality of how those policies are enacted and experienced on the ground, but also just a huge... I don't want to diss either one of them because they're both bright, engaging people, but more it's just... Like almost entrepreneurial is the way I would think about it, of thinking about Portland as a powerhouse and how can we move forward with the juice that we've got, if you want to be really street about it. You know, we're juiced right now. People from around the world love us. So what are the opportunity costs of not pressing hard, I guess, would be what I saw there. And I think that resonated with people. First 100 days is important. And actually, one of the pieces of advice, my job, again, at Portland State is to know who all the local experts on everything are. And one piece
Really?
Of,
that's part of your job?
That's my job.
What a great job.
I know. My Rolodex is so fat because it's like I know the experts from cities around the world and here, and I match them up, and they have conversations, and I sit there, and I go, oh, great. This is fantastic. And I learn a lot every day, which most people can't say. But one piece of advice I got was... Being a mayor in this commission form of government is very, very challenging. When you look at just everything built into the structure of our local government, that the most effective mayors in Portland's histories have had a laser-sharp focus and really dealt in their whole administration with one or two or maybe three big things. Yeah. And so when I ran, I was actually pretty clear that I had... two big things that I wanted to focus on, and that's why I would run for mayor and not say against Steve Novick or Amanda Fritz. Number one would be police reform, because historically, in all but one situation, our police commissioner is the mayor. And in America right now, cities are going to lead on police reform. That's not going to come from the federal level. And when you think about the civic capacity that Portland has, our commitment to public participation and our commitment to equity, I just thought we could do a bang-up job of re-envisioning community policing for the 21st century. I mean, what does it really mean to rethink it? If there's any city that can get away with that, I mean, this is not Chicago. This is not Boston, right? This is a young city, and our roots are shallow, relatively speaking. I mean, where else could you do it? And then the rest of the world will look to us as a model and things like that. And the other one was urban development. As someone who, that's my, my graduate degree is in sustainable urban development and planning, city planning. I really thought at a time of rapid growth, we need someone who's got some insight into how cities grow sustainably. So that's where my focus on transportation is. That's why I'm interested in density in ways that other people are like, oh, wait, slow. And I'm like, oh, no, we don't have time to go slow. Like, we need intense policy shaping our urban development right now because the market forces are so strong here. And city planning is one of the few socialist tools that we have left. I mean, I don't think the Planning Bureau is going to go out there and say that, but it's one of the few places that we use government to constrain market forces.
Socialism's a dirty word in the game of politics, I think.
Especially in American politics, yeah. Right?
You touched on community policing. I'm curious how that happens in a pragmatic way in the reality of day-to-day policing in Portland. How is that going to happen?
Well, I think the present challenges that we're seeing right now with the community oversight process is a perfect indication. You cannot commit to transformation halfway. Right. If you are going to transform a structure or system, you need to be deliberate about it. You need to be explicit about it with people that that's what's happening. And then you need to be intense. You need to go for it and transform that system, whether you're talking about gender equity in America and the pay gap or civil rights or because for me, police reform is about civil rights. Right. Most folks don't understand that we have a police union that's driving police policy. Now, what other unions, really, union employees and even our city or state, for that matter, shape urban policy or state policy to the extent that the police union states how shapes how policing is undertaken, right? I mean, that's a huge factor that we need to consider is what is our relationship to the police union? What does that look like? Right. How do we reshape that in ways that make sure that our police are taken care of, but that Portlanders' needs are being met? And that's where I think community oversight of the policy is important so that you don't just have this one police commissioner who's kind of emperor of the police, right. that policy is set and enforced by Portlanders. We know how to do public process here when we do it right. The trick is, can you figure out a way to give that real teeth and make it so that it's not lip service to a process, but that we haven't been able to get rid of so-called bad cops. We have confirmed, like, neo-Nazis on our police force. We can't even fire them. And this is Portland, like, liberal, progressive haven, you know? So we need to think carefully about what that would look like. And I think direct, perhaps elected community oversight would be something that we would go to. The charter review process is coming up in 2018, I think. So we're going to have a chance to review the city charter where some of those core processes, we could look at things like that. Like, what would it mean to have a citizen oversight that had real decision-making power about policies? That said, there are some other things that we would do immediately. I proposed a community trust in policing fund where we would go immediately to the philanthropic sector. I mean, I'm talking bypass the nonprofits altogether, straight to the foundations and say, as a matter of public health and human safety in our city and region, we need to invest in our police capacity immediately. We need to make sure that we have intense anti-bias training going on there. We need to make sure that we're recruiting and retaining young talent who are interested in living here and being a part of this community. We need to make sure that we're getting them through the process quickly and that they're being fairly compensated and that they have the resources that they need to do the job well. Our police are feeling very demoralized by what's going on, too. There are many, many, many good police. Like, the vast majority of them are fantastic. Yeah. They feel under-supported, they feel misunderstood, and that's because of a few bad apples that we have no power to get rid of. Yeah. So I would have focused the bulk of my time on policing, probably when I was thinking about it in working on policy. 60 to 70% of my time as mayor would probably be on police reform. And then the other part was thinking primarily, what does it mean to rethink the Portland Development Commission for the 21st century? I mean, that's a mid-century tool for, antiquated when it comes to how we do urban renewal. And also thinking about, a lot of our tax increment financing models are the tax increment financing districts are sunsetting. California's outlawed tax increment financing. There's a good reason for that. There are some serious equity issues. So can we innovate some new financing models to have some of the redevelopment outcomes without some of the inequities that are built into tax increment financing? Again, it's a place where intense social innovation could make a real difference for Portland, I think. And if we are able to accomplish that and find new revenue streams just by saying, what if you had to scrap that idea altogether, go back to the drawing board in the contemporary context and say, where can we capture value and how do we target that? I mean, I think we almost need to do something more like urban acupuncture. You know, when acupuncture, you get a needle here and it might affect an entirely different place in the body. You know, historically, tax increment financing was, you know, you push the point and the benefits are felt right in that targeted area. But what would it mean for us to maybe go places where the market is hot and capture value and use that to invest in places where the market is not? And maybe they'd be special transportation districts, or maybe they'd even be like innovation zones. I don't know what they would be, but I thought new urban policy for capturing value, especially from real estate investment and speculation, would be fantastic. So that's what I would have focused on primarily, and making sure that our equity goals were just trickling down through the city through some more innovations. I mean, just simple things like having a chief information officer, getting the data lined up. It's kind of an antiquated model over there in that building on 4th. I love them. They all work really, really hard, but it's terribly inefficient.
Right by my office.
Yeah.
Okay. So when did you decide that you wanted to run for mayor? How did this even happen?
I never decided that I wanted to do it. It was a necessary evil. I mean, when you think about, it's one of those things, just like when I opened my small business or started my PhD, if I knew then what I know now. Yes. partially.
Any regrets?
To be honest with you, it wasn't. I had been watching and watching and watching and talking with so many people about, if you run, I'll support you, I'll run your campaign for free, I'll give you all kinds of free consulting, yeah. You know, but I just couldn't get anyone to bite, and I'm waiting for the last minute, you know, and then Jules Bailey entered the race, and I was watching and hoping. I still didn't see the kind of things I wanted coming out. So really it was about, I think, just right after the first of the year, when I said we cannot have a discussion about Portland's future that doesn't talk about racism, that doesn't talk about equity, that's between two middle-class white men.
So you felt compelled to run for mayor?
I felt compelled, yeah. I felt it was my duty as an engaged Portlander, especially when I've had the luxury of the education I've gotten from Portland State and the work that I've done there over the last 8 years. I mean, I'm just a vessel for what's going well and what's not in this city, because I've had to share that with my visitors. I mean, those insights I did not glean by sitting back on, you know, the bus and reading the newspaper. I've been in meetings about these very issues for almost a decade at this point. We're looking at pretty soon.
Yeah, you made a name for yourself in a very short period of time. You're now a public figure.
Yeah.
And obviously people are going to ask, you know, what's next for Sarah?
Yeah, and I, to be honest, I don't know. The career politician is not something I aspire to. Like, I'm that kind of person who would love to be someone's chief of staff. I think that'd be a bang-up job for me. Day to day, I enjoy my freedom, and I enjoy my voice, too. And one thing I've learned from being a politician that's both been hard come by, but also very, very valuable, maybe not regrets, but let me tell you something I have intense gratitude for, is learning to be more careful with my words and more balanced and more measured in my opinion. Because there really are not just two sides to things, but three and four and five. And learning to value those, I think, is a trait that any good leader, whether they're elected or not, really needs to have.
I can get that sense from you just speaking to you now.
Yeah.
Very, very balanced.
Yeah.
Especially when talking about the police force, because there are great cops.
Oh, I mean, yeah. There's so much greatness in Portland. People, you know, a lot of times folks would say, why do you have to diss it all the time? And I'm like, well, in some ways I have the luxury of being a social critic. It's kind of like, if you don't get a PhD in urban studies and then not critique cities, how they work, how they don't. It's what I've been trained to do. You know, Portland, we do have the luxury of being desired, really, from people all around the world. And so for us to aspire to be better is not bad, in my opinion. But that said, giving credit where credit is due is very, very important. So,
now, you're a business owner yourself. Now, can you tell us a bit more about your background as running this place and the struggle?
Well, and this, one of the cutest things was a lot of my former employees all endorsed me for mayor because they were like, she's great, you know. She'll be the mayor that biscuits spring up around her feet when she walks around, because I'm known for making really good biscuits. But no, my background was, I was a chef in my previous career. So what brought
tough
me...
gig.
Yeah, and it was not easy. It's one reason why I changed careers after the birth of my daughter, because... The hours are brutal. The work is brutal. As we know now, the wages, the family leave, the sick leave, it's a brutal industry. The service industry all over is brutal. And again, I'm an innovator and a DIY person. So when my daughter was approaching school age and the time was coming short where my then husband and I would be able to trade off, you know, our schedules for childcare and things like that, we thought, well, what will we do? So a breakfast and lunch joint seemed the perfect, you know, run the business while she's at school, and she'd come home, and she was kind of a restaurant rat from a very early age. She was just 3 years old when, no, six. She was 6 years old when we opened. So, yeah.
Well, tough gig.
Well, the place does fine, so, but I think the neighborhood's changing out there, because when we went there, it was called Methlehem or Felony Flats, and that was like FOPO and Foster, you know, they call it, you know. It's up and coming, I'm told.
So next, I wanted to find out more about Sarah's work with Nancy Hales at First Stop Portland. From what I understand, they work in tandem with the Portland Development Commission.
First Stop Portland really came about because, as I mentioned, people from around the world were visiting Portland to study what was going well here. There's something in the water, they would say, and I would break that apart for them and say, it's not really. Let's demystify that and look at the components that are making the city what you see today. And the reason that we housed it in the university was so that we could serve as a neutral broker of the best information. But that came about because our public sector experts and our private sector experts were busy with their day jobs. They didn't want to be hosting these delegations from around the world. And again, housing us in the university gave us this capacity to engage in just a rich knowledge exchange that was bi-directional. So over the years, you know, in the early years, people were here to see what I call the green infrastructure. They wanted to ride a light rail train, see a streetcar under construction, look into a bioswale, walk on a green roof, kick the tires on our projects here. They wanted to see that. But over time, we've seen that shift, and I think in part it's because of the way that technology diffuses, is those that information has crossed borders through, you know, probably professional conferences and exchanges, and other countries and other cities have access to that information now. So what I increasingly see are visitors here to study, in addition to the standards. Don't get me wrong, everyone wants to ride the aerial tram, but and hear the story of why it is. But this notion of civic infrastructure, how do you build civic capacity? How do you do public-private partnerships in the face of increasing federal retrenchment? How do you engage your citizens in meaningful and effective ways? How do you build an inclusive city? How do you realize a goal as ephemeral as equity? What does that look like? What does it mean to...
These are all questions that are posed to you
from people who are visiting.
Yeah.
And so even that in and of itself means that there's still something Portland's doing right that the rest of the world hasn't figured out yet. And this is it, this capacity to build civic infrastructure. So some of the most interesting delegations we've had, when you think about it, one of my favorites anecdotally is the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, who, when you think of this guy being like the 10th richest dude on the planet, he can pretty much hire any consultant or any planning firm to help him achieve whatever goals he wants. He was the planning director at the time. And he was educated in the West, so totally erudite guy, in touch with the best thinking on cities. But his question for us was this: how do you get your contractors to follow through on the agreements? How do you get your projects built on time and under budget? Because we've got this system here, it goes like this, and it goes like this, and it goes like that, and you guys seem to have this, this, and that. And he sat down with people who've been on, you know, complex projects here and said, here's how you build development agreements, and here's how you build trusting relationships over time, and here's how you build an accountability to your contracts. I mean, you don't think about it that that's what he would need, but that's what kind of thing they're talking about, right? another one of my favorite delegations, and I still stay in touch with them. I stay in touch with so many. It's one reason why I stay on Facebook, that and my mom. We had a delegation here from Laikipia County, Kenya, right after the federal government devolved, rewrote their constitution and devolved a whole set of powers from the federal level to these states, which are they call counties. And we hosted one of those county assemblies for a week. And they looked at everything from sustainable development to civic engagement. And they studied our governance model inside and out as a sustainable governance model and learned lessons about what we would do. And you have this guy, one of the assembly members is a farmer, and he's got 10 sons. And he's like, we're trying to figure out land use. And he's talking to our former, you know, Secretary of State about how do we figure out statewide land use law that helps me ensure that I get land to my 10 sons. I mean, and these are the people who framed Senate Bill 100. They came up with statewide land use law. I mean, so this is, to me, this is magic. You know, and then you sit them down with Earl Blumenauer and he talks about why building sidewalks and compact neighborhoods matter. And this is a place that, you know, is urbanizing quickly, and hopefully some of the principles, urban design and urban development, will, you know, inform how they do things in a sustainable, more human-centric way.
I'd love to hear your thoughts about smart cities.
Yeah. And this is interesting because, you know, a lot of times what we end up with is, just like any field, there are trendy terms, right? A decade ago, it was about cities, sustainable cities. Now, the digital divide. There are these things that become like, you know, hot-button issues.
Right.
Right now, it's resilient cities, right? So resiliency is at the on the edge of all the urbanists' tongues. But smart cities has some traction in some serious places. I mean, India is investing hardcore in smart cities technology, as you mentioned, Singapore, China, some places. And I worry. I am not a technological determinist. I had this conversation with someone the other day about the autonomous vehicles. I do not think technology will save humans ever. I think that humans can come up with technologies to solve problems, but that we shouldn't look to them to save us. And so I think about what does it mean to move beyond the concept of of smart cities, where we use data and technology to be the best that we can be. To wise cities. What does it mean to be a truly wise city, such that the data that we are able to collect, the technology we're able to deploy, is actually working to solve some of our most intractable social problems, not just to make our places more efficient or cleaner or more, but really what does it mean to use them to level the playing field too? And I don't know that places like India, maybe with the lag time that they have in urban development, are going to have that, the luxury of that kind of view that we would have in a place like an avant-garde advanced city in an already developed nation like, you know, Portland in the U.S., if you will.
You did very well in this election. What is next for Sarah? What direction are you going in?
Yeah, I think it's important, not just for me, but anyone who's really out there and concerned about what's going on in Portland, is to find ways to get engaged and use what you have going for you to help realize your aims, your desired outcomes. A lot of folks are very concerned about the federal election right now.
Yes.
We're all concerned. Yeah. Many of them worry that their Oregon vote is slightly irrelevant. So go home and phone bank on Sunday night. Make calls to Ohio. Make calls to Florida. You know, like, do what you can do to make Portland a better place. Don't be defeatist about it. For me, that means right now I'm using my voice to try and help focus energy and attention on making sure that our streets are safe for everyone who's trying to use them. You don't have to be in a steel box to survive, you know, your path from home to work, let's hope. And also making sure that the folks on our streets who are living because they don't have homes are safe. I mean, it's all to me about what's happening in our streets right now, and even police reform is about our streets. So do I show up and protest? Yes, but more than that, I stay on top of the city hall agenda. I know when there's a council session where they're going to be discussing something that I want to talk about, and I show up or I write a letter still. Not everyone's going to have the luxury of a flexible enough schedule and benefactors to run for public office. But there are things I think we can even do as small business owners, as parents, to activate around doing this together. It's what's going to make Portland work in the future is the people. It's our greatest strength. We're not an affluent place. We're not even a major metropolitan area. We're tiny. I mean, we're barely not a town. And some folks would argue that we're still a bit of a town, just a really getting big one. But what, we're 24th or 25th largest in the U.S. We've got a long way to go before we're a major player in the global marketplace, let alone even the U.S. marketplace.
That's very true.
I think we have to stay the course.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today, Sarah. It was so much fun to finally meet you.
Oh, thanks. It was a pleasure. I appreciate it. I look forward to listening to the podcast.